Greetings and welcome to the Asian American and Asian Research Institute's Friday evening lecture series. I'm Anthony Wong, program coordinator of the Institute. Welcome on this beautiful Good Friday evening. Right? Thanks for joining us tonight for our talk on Dismantling Everyday Discrimination, Microaggressions Towards LGBTQ People by Dr. Kevin Nadal. This is actually Dr. Nadal's sixth presentation at the Institute, not as many as your Instagram reels, but we'll get there. And his most recent talk was in spring 2021 on the Brown Asian American Movement. Kevin Nadal, PhD, is a distinguished professor of psychology at both John Jay College of Criminal Justice and the CUNY Graduate Center. He received his doctorate in counseling psychology from Columbia University in New York City and is one of the leading researchers in understanding the impacts of microaggressions or subtle forms of discrimination on the mental and physical health of people of color, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer people, and other marginalized groups. Dr. Nadal has published over 100 works on multicultural issues in the fields of psychology and education. He's a California-bred New Yorker. He was named one of People Magazine's Hottest Bachelors in 2006, and is one of NBC Prize 30 in Pride 30 back in 2018. Dr. Nadal is the author of 14 books, including Filipino-American Psychology, That's So Gay, Microaggressions in the Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Community, Microaggressions and Traumatic Stress, and Queering, Law, and Order. In addition, Dr. Nadal is part of our editorial board for the CUNY Forum, the Institute's academic publication, which will be publishing our 10th commemorative volume this month. And without further ado, please welcome Dr. Kevin Nadal.
Thank you so much for being here. Thank you to everyone who's online and joining us. I'm really just happy to have an opportunity just to present my work. Again, I didn't realize it had been six times that I presented at ARRI. And I will happily present at ARRI every other time from now on, just because ARRI has always been such a supportive community, an opportunity for us to be able to exchange ideas, and really just to find community and support for each other. As you all may know, there is a severely underrepresented percentage of Asian Americans in higher education, particularly in academia, in positions of faculty positions and so forth. And so any opportunity for us to share our work is something that's really important. And I hope that, you know, might encourage folks who may not be in higher education or academia to be able to consider entering academia so we can break those bamboo ceilings and increase the number of us that are in academia. And so with that, I wanted to thank the staff of ARRI and Anthony Wong particularly for inviting me to talk about my book, newest book, Dismantling Everyday Discrimination, Microaggressions Towards LGBTQ People. This is actually the second edition of a previous book that I've written called That's So Gay, Microaggressions and the LGBT Community. When the 10th anniversary of that book was approaching, I asked the editors, I said, I think it would be worthwhile for us to do a second edition. And for those of you who are in publishing or academia, know that like second editions sometimes don't really happen. And so I was really honored, humbled, and happy that they were pretty gracious and welcoming of us revisiting this book for a second edition. And so this is now my 14th book. So I begin every presentation by thanking the ancestors, people who I have never met in my life, but who have shaped me in profound ways, people who have had the opportunities to trailblaze and pave paths for those of us that would not have had any opportunities had it not been for them. And so as a Filipino-American, I honor labor rights activists like Philip Veracruz and Larry Itlio. They were among the 100,000 Filipino Americans who were in the United States prior to 1930. They were among those that started the United Farm Workers movement, but oftentimes don't get credit for it. And so when we think about the erasure of Asian Americans in general, but even more specifically Filipino Americans, I am thankful for Manong Philip and Manong Larry for paving those paths for us, and you know, allowing for our voices to be heard, because they were the first to initiate what is now known as one of the greatest labor movements in modern history. As a queer person of color, I honor people like Audre Lorde, James Baldwin, Sylvia Rivera, Marsha P. Johnson, and Wei Hua, folks who had the audacity to live in their most authentic truths in a time in which being trans or queer could mean violence or even death. They still managed to persevere and to be able to advocate for our civil rights and our equities. And when I think about them, I am very grateful because while I have been able to live a fairly comfortable life as a queer Filipino American, you know, nowadays in 2023, but growing up in the 80s and 90s, it was their voices in as early as the 60s that help society to recognize that we were human and that we deserved to be treated as such, and that we deserved love and respect. And so I thank them and I bring them into this space because I definitely would not be able to write a book like this unless they were there first. So I want to just, again, acknowledge that this book is a second edition. It first came out in 2013, and it was titled back then, That's So Gay, Microaggressions and the Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Community, 2023. We changed the title, and one of the reasons why we changed the title was because there was a genuine reaction that my publisher and others had that maybe people aren't saying that's so gay anymore. Maybe that was something that was very commonplace, you know, in the 80s and 90s, even early 2000s. But in the past 10 years, it's something that you find less and less of. Not to say that homophobia doesn't exist, not to say that homophobic language doesn't exist, but this particular phrase, which was very rampant up until 2013 and beyond, or around that time, was something that we're seeing less. And so actually I asked a lot of my friends, colleagues, did some polls on social media, like, what do you think? Should we change the title? And people from their own lived experiences, as well as the results of these like really informal polls that I did, people really revealed that That's Okay was used much less. And if it was used, there would be people that would stand up against it, or people who would correct others, or people who would challenge people that use those phrases. I talked to a lot of my educator friends, and I was like, do people still say That's Okay in the schools? And they're like, yeah, sure, they might. But in 2010, people heard it all the time, but in 2023, a lot of young people know they're not supposed to say that, or actually might have less homophobic or transphobic views, young people at least, not talking about like older folks who are oftentimes in government leader positions, but young people just weren't saying things like that. So one, we decided to change the title and came up with this Dismantling Everyday Discrimination, towards LGBTQ people. But also, one of the things that I reflected on was like, wow, does some of our scholarship actually work? That we're telling people to not say that's so gay. And now 10 years later, people are saying that's so gay a lot less, to the point that, you know, overwhelmingly people in the communities that I surveyed, like, were able to say that it was something that they noticed less. And so that was something that was really humbling as well as exciting for me, that maybe we can change cultures. Maybe we can change societies. Maybe we can, you know, do our parts to ensure that more equity is met and that people might feel less excluded in the world. And so that's a little story about why it's no longer called That's Okay. It was simply because it just wasn't a commonplace phrase anymore. And so I want to just tell you a little bit about the book. I have some books here for sale if people are interested as well. But the book has really evolved since the 2013 2013 printing. And that is for a few reasons. One, because of the change in time and society and just how different life may be now than it was even just 10 years ago. The second piece is that there has been an immense amount of research on microaggressions and especially anti-LGBTQ microaggressions that has emerged, which has, you know, allowed for this growth in the types of scholarship that we produce and even just the way that I was able to even approach this work. And so, you know, from this table of contents, some of this is very similar to the 2013 edition, but there's some pieces that are especially notably different, remarkably different than that previous printing, and I just want to point out a few of them. So we have our preface, our introduction to microaggressions, a brief history of LGBTQ and civil rights. This was a very rewarding chapter to rewrite because from 2013 to present day, so much history has occurred. So I imagine, or I ask you all to imagine what 2013 was like. 2013 was a year in which you still very infrequently saw LGBTQ people on television. I think Ellen may have been one of the few people you saw regularly. Drag Race had started, but that was something that was more reserved for, it was on Logo, and then people within the LGBTQ communities may have watched something like that, but not necessarily that was something that was popular on the mainstream. You also saw a lot of state laws that were trying to prevent same-sex couples from getting married. So that was the hot topic at the time, was marriage equality. By 2013, 11 states had marriage equality, and that number had jumped significantly from even just a couple years ago, or a couple years prior to that, in which there were only 4 states that had marriage equality. And so that was a big topic, was whether or not same-sex couples could get married. And that was something that you may have seen on television shows like Modern Family, later even on Glee. That was what our world was when it was 2013 and we thought about LGBTQ people on a national level, right? Across most states, LGBTQ people couldn't get married. When people were running for political office, LGBTQ issues were rarely addressed. Even President Obama, who was viewed as one of the more liberal presidents in the history of the U.S., didn't even address LGBTQ issues because there was a fear that in talking about those things that he might lose some voters. That was just 10 years ago. Right? And so I ask people to imagine that, because what has happened since then, right? So in 2013 is when the first Supreme Court decision occurred, which targeted the Defense of Marriage Act. In 2015 was when the Supreme Court passed the ruling that legalized same-sex, in essence, across all 50 states. We have now seen an increase in LGBTQ representation across all forms of media. We also have this increase in social media in general, which has allowed LGBTQ people of all backgrounds to share their stories, especially when mainstream media wasn't sharing our stories. We even have seen such an increase in LGBTQ communities of color having opportunities to tell and narrate their own stories through their own perspectives. So with shows like Pose, where they are even able to center LGBTQ, black and brown voices and narratives. And so a lot has happened, but I also ask folks to think about the ways that heterosexism and homophobia and transphobia have continued. That with all of those wins, there have also been many ways in which people who are considered more conservative may have tried to take away those rights from LGBTQ folks. Presently, there are laws across many states that prevent educators from talking about LGBTQ issues in in the classroom. There are states that prevent trans people from the opportunity to have access to health, especially young trans people. There are state laws that prevent trans people from participating in sports. And the list goes on. And so with all of these wins and in many ways in which LGBTQ people's lives and experiences have been normalized and even celebrated across much of the United States, there are also a lot of people who are trying to bring that down. And so chapter one talks about that brief history, starting from the first queer people who have been documented in ancient Egypt and ancient Greece, ancient Rome, to the two-spirited people of North America, to the queer and gender nonconforming people of Southeast Asia, particularly the Philippines and Thailand and even in India. And so it's being able to capture that broad history is something that was really rewarding because I got to see how much has changed, but it was also really sad because it also got to see how much has really stayed the same. I'll break down a little bit more of some of the other chapters, but I wanted just to highlight that there were some chapters that had to emerge because back then there weren't a lot of conversations on these topics, and also there weren't a lot of research articles or studies about these topics. So in the first edition, we had chapter 5 that just generally talked about intersectional experiences, intersectionalities, meaning the notion that people of historically marginalized identities and multiple historically marginalized identities may navigate systems of oppression differently than people who have singular identities that have been historically marginalized. But we had to expand these chapters to include microaggressions, not just towards people of multiple marginalized identities in general, but specifically towards LGBTQ people of color, LGBTQ people with disabilities, LGBTQ people of diverse sizes, older LGBTQ people, LGBTQ youth, LGBTQ people of religious and non-religious backgrounds, LGBTQ immigrants, and LGBTQ poor and working class people. And the reason why this is so remarkable for me is that it really demonstrates that there are more and more people who are studying these topics. Prior to, let's say, even like 2000, there was hardly anything written about LGBTQ people at all. Between 2000 and 2010-ish, you might see that there was an increase in LGBTQ issues, and even an increase in LGBTQ media, but one of the trends is that they would center white experiences, that they would center white cis and white cis male experiences, and that was supposed to represent the entirety of the LGBTQ plus narrative. So in the past 20 years, there has been a huge increase in the number of not just research studies, but also works in the humanities and also other media forms, whether it be films and novels, that center some of these other intersectionalities. So for example, we see more written on LGBTQ people of color and their experiences and how they may experience racism within LGBTQ communities, homophobia or transphobia within their families and within communities of color, and the intersection of both in general society. We've seen an increase in research regarding LGBTQ people with disabilities, LGBTQ immigrants, particularly undocumented immigrants, and the list goes on. And so again, so much has changed in the past 10 years, which shows that there is an interest in people learning about these nuanced identities and experiences, that no longer can we center the narratives of privileged groups within marginalized groups. In other words, no longer can we say that there is one universal LGBTQ experience or that universal LGBTQ experience revolves or involves whiteness or maleness or cisgender identity, but rather that there are multiple identities for us to consider. And then finally, chapter 8 and chapter 9 talk about the processes in dealing with microaggressions, and considerations for targets and allies, and then recommendations. And, you know, what's interesting with my experience in revisiting some of these chapters, again, is that because of some of the progress that has occurred, in the past 10 years, that there are different approaches, that would be necessary. So for example, when I think about recommendations for people who may consider themselves allies or advocates or upstanders, I hope people can imagine or just reflect on what 2013 was like. In 2013, especially in liberal places like New York City, we had to convince people that LGBTQ people were normal or deserving of humanity or wanted to be like everyone else in some ways or were just needed equal rights. There would be people that would consider themselves to be generally liberal, to be Democrats, to be pro-civil rights, that would still either be overtly anti-LGBTQ or have a lot of hesitations. Right? So they would say like, well, I'm all about like, gay people, like they can live their lives. I just don't want to see it. Right? Or what they do is behind the bedroom. That was a very common sentiment, up until like 2010, 2015, prior to marriage equality. Right? Or people would say things like, as a Catholic or as a Christian, I just can't get behind this because my religion says this. And that was a common thought just 10 years ago. And so while that is still something that may be current for a lot of folks and still a challenge, you know, to get your family members, community members to reflect or even challenge themselves upon their heterosexist or transphobic biases, it might be different for a lot of folks. A lot of folks now might consider themselves to be very open-minded, or they say things like, oh, I have a gay friend, or like, oh, like I once went to a gay wedding, or oh, I know a transgender, you know. They'll say things that might be really well-intentioned, but actually might still reflect some of their biases. And so maybe now the approach to working with people or challenging people with microaggressions might be different, because now you're not just trying to convince them that LGBTQ people deserve the equal rights, but maybe now you're challenging them to reflect upon their implicit biases or the other ways in which they may manifest discrimination towards LGBTQ folks. So I wanted to share a little bit about microaggressions. I promised Anthony and Ari, like I want to just do a quick overview because I want people to actually buy the book. I can't just give you all the information. You have to be able to read the book. But I want to just share a little bit about the term microaggressions, how it came to be, and why it was so important for me to study. But as a definition, microaggressions are defined as a brief and commonplace daily verbal, behavioral, or environmental indignities, whether intentional or unintentional, that communicate hostile, derogatory, or negative slights and insults towards various people, particularly those of historically marginalized groups. The term microaggression was first coined in the 1970s by a Black American psychiatrist and professor named Chester Pierce. And when he first talked about microaggressions, he was noticing the different ways that Black Americans were being portrayed in the media and how those may be reflective of people's biases. And so a lot of his work was breaking down some of the images of Black people in television particularly, and how that might have an effect on Black people's views of themselves or even the public views of them. And so he labeled them as microaggressions. Some folks decided to continue with some of that work. For example, Daniel Solorosano of UCLA wrote about racial microaggressions in the late 90s and early 2000s. To describe the ways in which students students of color may experience subtle forms of discrimination on campus. And so he wrote a little bit about that. But it wasn't until 2007 when Daryl Wing Su, a Chinese American professor at Teachers College, who also was my mentor when I was a student at Teachers College, started to write about microaggressions, racial microaggressions, and the ways that they manifest in that current moment in time. So it was 2007 was when our first article came out in The American Psychologist, the most cited journal, academic journal in psychology. And that changed everything. This article wrote about the many ways in which people of color of diverse racial groups may experience more subtle forms of racism. While we recognize that more overt racism, like hate crimes and lynchings and police violence still occurred, that there were some everyday sorts of incidents that may be based on people's biases, and that oftentimes were unintentional and benevolent, but may still have major impact on the people who experience them. And so some of the examples of that original paper were the experiences that a lot of Asian Americans have in which they are presumed to be perpetual foreigners. And so in which somebody says to them, hey, where are you from? And the person says, oh, I'm from Queens. And they say, no, where are you really from? And the person says, Jackson Heights. And then they say, no, where are you really from? And that person says, I'm not giving you my address. And so this notion that this person isn't really American or isn't telling the truth, or they couldn't possibly be from here. They couldn't possibly be born here. And so while it might just be an innocuous comment that's made, if you're an Asian American person who has heard this throughout your lifetime, it can feel really frustrating, annoying, maddening. It can make you feel as if you're dehumanized or somebody doesn't see you or is reducing you to just one trait. And that's what happens with microaggressions, is that even if they're not necessarily overt, and even if they're not physically violent, they can have a profound impact on your life, the ways that you navigate the world, and even your mental health. And so that's when some of the research started to focus on microaggressions and people of color's experience in that current moment in time. In the late 2000s, early 2010s, is when we started to do some of that research. And so research has found at that moment and continued since then to demonstrate that racial microaggressions can be a predictor of things like mental health problems, depression, anxiety, traumatic symptoms, of things like low self-esteem, of things like low educational attainment, and even physical issues, things like poor physical health, sleep problems, drinking problems, smoking problems, etc., that the more microaggressions that you experience, that it may have a negative impact on these various aspects of your life. And so that was what some of that earlier research, beginning with Daryl Wing Su and our team in 2007, that's what that covered. In 2009 or 10, I approached Daryl and I said, hey, to my mentor, I said, I think we should also cover issues related to LGBTQ folks. There hasn't been a lot that has been written on LGBTQ folks at the time in general. And there specifically hasn't been a lot on the impact of racial or of heterosexist homophobic discrimination. A lot of the research in the 90s and early 2000s that had to do with LGBTQ folks had to do with violence, which perhaps rightfully it should have, because of that increase of violence that people were seeing. There was a lot of research or increase in research that especially happened after Matthew Shepard was murdered in 1997. And so people were interested in the impact of violence on LGBTQ folks. As a side note, what's of interest is that when Matthew Shepard was murdered, there were a bunch of these studies that started to unpack that impact of anti-queer, anti-trans violence, but mostly anti-gay violence. But it centered white cisgender experiences. We know that lots of other LGBTQ folks, especially LGBTQ people of color, and especially trans people, had been targeted by violence before, but it had never made the national news. It had never made national headlines, and therefore it wasn't something that was of interest. But one of the positives of that is that even if it did center this one person who was victimized by violence, it started those conversations. And so this is when trans people start to come forth and say, hey, we've been targeted by violence. There are so many trans people that have been killed that just are never named. It was around that time that the Trans Day of Remembrance started, TDOR, in which every year, annually in November, they recognize all of the trans people who had been killed across the world in that past year. That's something we didn't even do until 2009. And now, especially if you're within the queer and trans community, we see that regularly, how many trans people have been killed. We weren't even doing that over 15 years ago. During that time is also when community organizations like the Anti-Violence Project started to publish reports on the number of violent incidents that LGBTQ folks had experienced. And their reports over the years have consistently revealed that trans people and gender nonconforming people and queer and trans people of color were the largest or had the highest prevalence of anti-LGBTQ hate of any other LGBTQ subgroup. And so those research studies started to emerge to help us understand what happens to LGBTQ people as they navigate the world. But again, I want to bring it back just to this notion that there was no research on discrimination, or very little research on discrimination, and very little research on even subtle discrimination. Another thing that emerged during this time in 2010 was that there were these incidents of bullying that started to make national headlines. That there were gay and queer kids, some trans at that time, who ended up dying by suicide because they were bullied to the extent that they no longer wanted to live. And so some of those made national headlines at that time. And that led to this national campaign that people might remember called the No Hate Campaign. Or the It Gets Better Campaign. Sorry, two different campaigns. No Hate came after marriage equality was voted against in California. The It Gets Better Campaign started after these incidents of bullying. And so both of these campaigns actually were pretty effective in increasing that national conversation, but there still wasn't a lot of research on microaggressions or some of the more nuanced forms of bias that LGBTQ people experience. And so with Daryl Tsu, I said we should write about microaggressions towards LGBTQ folks, and he says, yeah, that's a great idea. I think you should. And so we started to collect some of the examples throughout the literature and even in mainstream media of the types of microaggressions that people experience. I was able to co-publish a chapter in Daryl Wing Su's book on microaggression that focused on the types of microaggressions that LGBTQ people experience. And that led to lots of research that I was able to do as a young assistant professor, I was like 10 years ago, 15 years ago, assistant professor at John Jay College, where my research team and I really wanted to voice the perspectives of microaggressions that LGBTQ people experienced. And so that led to a lot of studies, which then led to the first book of That's So Gay. And so here's what some of the things that we found with microaggressions and types of microaggressions that people within the LGBTQ experience, Q identity or communities experience. So these are microaggressions based on gender identity and sexual orientation. Some of these are derived from the taxonomy that I talked about that we published in the first chapter, or as a chapter in the first book on microaggressions. But some of the general themes were the use of heterosexist and transphobic terminology. And so some of the more innocuous everyday things that people say that might have transphobic or heterosexist bias embedded in them. So as a first example, when people used to say more often, "That's so gay," they weren't necessarily saying that, or weren't really necessarily intentionally saying that, "Oh, that's so gay," meaning like that's something that gay people would do or like, but they were just saying "that's so gay," meaning "that's so weird," or "I don't like that," or "that's so different." But yet, why do you have to bring gay people around for that, right? But they made gay synonymous for things that are bad. In years since then, there were terms like "no homo" that people were using as a way of demonstrating that if you did something that was considered to be gay or feminine, or in which you showed some emotion towards a person of your same sex, especially when men were when male friends showed any affection to each other, they might say things like "no homo." Some of these phrases, a lot of times, like, these words, phrases that become commonplace in any society, people might not realize what they're derived in, that they're derived in this notion of homophobia, that it's weird or uncommon for men to show affection to each other. So they say "no homo," to each other. But there are lots of other phrases. When people say things like "tranny" to others, it's a transphobic slur that is often used. But even like comments that people make, if you see a genderqueer person and a person, an adult, says to them like, "What are you? Are you a boy or a girl?" Very transphobic language, because people don't recognize that gender is fluid and beyond a spectrum, and that there are more than just two genders in our society. Language that people hear are common microaggressions. The endorsement of heteronormative or gender conforming cultural behaviors, these are microaggressions in which people presume that others should be more heterosexual or should be more gender conforming. So for example, when parents enforce their kids to dress in a way that matches their sex assigned at birth, so making their girls or daughters wear dresses from an early age, telling their boys that boys don't cry, or you need to man up from an early age. This is promoting gender normative behaviors. And if you all remember childhood is where we pick up a lot of messages about a lot of things about the world. But when you hear those things from a very young age, and if you do identify as trans or even queer, that it might make you feel bad about yourself. It might make you feel that you are different if you don't like certain things, or if you do like other things, which then may have an impact on your mental health. When bisexual, pansexual people come out, oftentimes people will say things like, "Are you sure? Are you just confused?" And again, that's the endorsement that heterosexuality is the norm, and so that they should they shouldn't be bisexual, or that they should lean towards being heterosexual, even though that might not match with their identity or their experiences. Another example of a microaggression is the assumption of the universal LGBTQ experience or LGBTQ experiences. And these are microaggressions in which people presume that all LGBTQ people are the same. So, for example, when I was sharing before, when we center white heteros or white gay cisgender experiences, people oftentimes presume that that's what all LGBTQ people do. So even just presuming that everyone who is a cis man would be feminine and not like sports and like more things that are more feminine, like arts or fashion, can be an example of a microaggression. Presuming that all cis women who are queer would be butch or male presenting or not like feminine things and would like all masculine things could be considered a microaggression, presuming that all trans people would want to transition through LGBTQ affirming or trans affirming surgeries or medical procedures because they view gender on a binary, that would be considered the assumption of a universal LGBTQ experience, rather than recognizing that all people can be different. Not everyone has to like the same thing, in the same way that not all Asian Americans like the same thing or have the same experience, or in the same way that not all women have the same experience, or in the same way that not all people from any group have the same experience. We shouldn't presume that all LGBTQ folks would have similar experiences. And so those are some of the microaggressions that have occurred and have been reported through our many research studies and so forth. The idea of exoticization or tokenism, these are experiences in which queer trans people are oftentimes viewed as different, objectified. Sometimes people feel tokenized, in which someone might say something like, I need a new gay friend, or I don't have any trans friend, will you be my trans friend? Which sounds ridiculous if you hear something like that, but at the same time, it's something that many of our research participants shared as a common experience, because people just didn't know what to do. And a lot of times these exoticization, tokenism types of microaggressions come from well-intentioned people who think that maybe they're open-minded, they have gay or queer or trans friends, and so they say things like this, but when you receive or are the recipient of this, you might actually view it as being quite biased. The idea of discomfort or disapproval of the LGBTQ experience, there are many, there's a spectrum of how that might manifest. Sometimes it might be more overt, where someone might say something that might be less microaggressive and might be more overtly homophobic. Someone who says, like, I don't like gay people, like, you're evil, you're immoral, those sorts of things. But there are some subtle ways that this might manifest, right? It might be something like, someone not inviting a queer person out for drinks at the workplace because they just don't feel like they would be fun, or don't feel they would connect to that person. So there is a more of a subtle exclusion of that person. Having a favorite child is something that has people reported, like where someone might say, a queer person may say that their parents favored their heterosexual sibling because that heterosexual sibling could participate in more heteronormative activities like weddings and marriages and children. And not that queer and trans people can't do that, but historically they hadn't, and so maybe some of these heterosexual siblings were favored more. The denial of the reality of heterosexism and transphobia, a lot of times this might be referred to as gaslighting, when someone says something like, it's not that bad, or are you serious, like that doesn't really happen still, when in reality these are things that still happen on a regular basis, and not just microaggressions, but even overt, violent homophobia and transphobia that still happens to LGBTQ folks. For people to deny that is an example of a microaggression. The assumption of sexual pathology or abnormality. These are comments, behaviors, which reflect that people think that things that are normalized within LGBTQ communities are bad or different or abnormal. As an example, a lot of times when people think about sexuality, they think that monogamy is the only way to go, that any relationship that isn't monogamous is somehow inferior or set up for failure, when in reality, when queer couples engage in non-monogamy, they actually might have healthier relationships, according to some studies, and even long-lasting relationships, right? The notion of sex and sexuality, because our society is generally centered on Western Puritan values, people are oftentimes afraid to talk about sex, and there are certain stigmas when we talk about sex, versus within trans and queer communities, talking about sex might be more normalized. And so when queer or trans people either talk about sex or participate in sex, they're viewed as being so sexually, They're viewed as being too much in terms of their sexuality, or that they're trying to indoctrinate children on their sexuality, when in reality, they're not, or that maybe they're more sexually free. And so there's this notion of, who gets to be the authority on certain things and who gets to be viewed as pathological in some ways. And the last one is this, denial of, individual heterosexism or transphobia. This is also another form of gaslighting. That this might be an example of someone who denies that they personally are heterosexist or transphobic, even when someone might call them out on it. So, for example, if you commit a microaggression and then somebody says, like, hey, I was hurt by that, I thought that that might be a reflection of your homophobic bias, and that person says, I'm not homophobic, I have a gay friend, I'm not transphobic, I donate to HRC. So any number of things that people might do try to deny their biases, when in reality, maybe we all should be a little reflective of our own biases and how that impacts our relationships with others. I want to just quickly shout out the notion of intersectional microaggressions. These are microaggressions that may occur based on multiple identities. I shared with you earlier some of the chapters that focus on people of historically marginalized identities. So there is a chapter on LGBTQ people of color, people with disabilities, people of diverse sizes, older people, younger people, and then religious groups, immigrants, and poor and working class folks. But so many different types of microaggressions that occur based on these intersections. I mentioned before, LGBTQ people of color may experience racism within the LGBTQ community, homophobia and transphobia within their own families, and then within general society, a combination of all sorts of oppression. But I want people just to really imagine that. Like, if you are an LGBTQ person of color, let's say even specifically an LGBTQ Asian American, and you go to your family and you experience within your family homophobic or transphobic comments, people who say things to you in which they're uncomfortable with your sexuality or your gender identity, and having to navigate that. And then you go out with your friends later and you go into a bar that might be a primarily white space, and there you might be tokenized or exoticized. People might make comments about your racial group, your religion, your ethnic group, may even sexually objectify you in certain ways. And then you go leave that and you go into the workplace, and then while in the workplace you might experience some casual racism, some casual homophobia. Where are you free from experiencing any of these biases? Hopefully there are some safe spaces that you can be in where you feel supported. But it just goes to show that when you have intersectional identities, you're navigating different worlds that may target you in different ways. And I'm not here to say or argue with anyone about whether racism or homophobia is more oppressive than the other and so forth, but rather to challenge folks to think about what it's like to have to navigate all of those things all the time. And so, you know, even looking at people with disabilities, LGBTQ people with disabilities describe the ableism that they experience within LGBTQ communities, looking at even LGBTQ spaces, whether it's bars or lounges, clubs, or community centers, do they always have accessibility? Do they always have a ramp? If there are conferences, do they always have audio accessibility? Do they have video accessibility for people who aren't even able to go to those spaces? Those are things for people within LGBTQ communities to consider. And then again, when they go into their own families, are they going to experience some ableism? When they go into their own families, are they going to experience some heterosexism or transphobia and so forth? And so just thinking about the different ways that intersectionalities may impact people in different ways because of the microaggressions that they experience. I'm just going to skip around and then we're going to end soon, but talking about just some recommendations. In the book, I highlight all sorts of recommendations, but I try to break it down into different sectors, and I'm just going to share three of them. So within families and communities, what are some of the things that we can do to address not just the microaggressions, but also the systemic oppression that people may experience in their lives, right? So like when we think about families and communities, I think for me, the first thing I think about are kids, and what are some of the ways in which we can talk to kids about not just homophobia and transphobia, but about equity and justice in general from an early age, so that by the time they are younger adults and even then older adults, that perhaps they're not repeating the past generational biases that have been passed down from people before them. And this is why it's so important for us to be able to have conversations about equity in schools. At age-appropriate levels, right? Like, I don't think that we need to talk to five-year-olds about sex and, you know, like, even the logistics of sex. I don't think we even need to do that until maybe they're preteens to prepare them for when they might find themselves in those situations. But we can teach a five-year-old about things like equity and love and treating people with respect and the notion that people might have different families or come from different racial groups, have different skin colors, come in different sizes, have different accessibilities, or have different, ways of being. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. So the people that are trying to remove those conversations from happening in schools are really trying to deprive young children from learning basic lessons about humanity. And so I think that's something that's important for families now to do, especially if they're removing it from schools, because families have the ultimate influence in teaching a lot of young people about lessons about life and love and equity. Within schools and workplaces, you know, depending on where you are, like, there might be harder battles to fight if you're in states in which they're preventing you from even having these conversations. Then, you know, that's a battle to fight that might be more difficult, demanding that there be laws that are passed that involve or include queer theory, or even just basic lesson plans about equity. That might be something that might be more difficult. But even in more liberal states or states that aren't having these sorts of laws, for us to think about ways in which we can integrate lessons about queerness and transness at an early age and in age-appropriate ways. I think a lot of times what's really difficult for everybody, not just queer and trans people, is the notion of how we've been socialized, what we've been socialized to believe in. And so a lot of queer and trans people themselves have what we might call internalized oppression, internalized heterosexism, and internalized transphobia, where because we ourselves didn't learn to value our diverse sexualities or gender identities, we might not know how to talk to kids about it. Or we might think that we're stepping the line ourselves, or stepping over the line ourselves, or that it's inappropriate to talk about these things. When in reality, heterosexual people talk about heterosexual things all the time, and they don't question themselves on that. And so I think in school systems, it's really important for everybody, queer and trans people, and also heterosexual, cisgender people, to think about the ways that we can be more inclusive, and to not second guess this notion that not to second guess it, because there is this notion that everyone deserves to learn about others who are different and to be given all the information before they can make a decision on how they want to live, as opposed to just depriving them of all this information altogether. Within workplaces, I think it's important for people to reflect on the ways in which heterosexism and transphobia oftentimes still persist in different institutions, organizations, in different companies, corporations, and for people to address those things, right? There are institutional aspects involved in this. For example, like whether or not your company offers benefits to same-sex couples, whether your company offers medical benefits for trans and genderqueer people, whether your company, you know, even, you know, recognizes things like parental leave that are equitable for LGBTQ couples. And so those are things that are more institutional, but also thinking about just the ways that people are able to just show up in the workplace. I once met somebody casually, I don't even remember their name, but they said, like, you know, one of the things that really bothers me about homophobia and transphobia is that somebody just doesn't even get to talk about what they did over the weekend. When heterosexual, cisgender people come back from a long weekend, especially, they get to say, like, oh, my family did this, and we went to this wedding, and we went to this vacation, and that sort of thing. But if you're in a place that is homophobic or transphobic, when you're a queer or trans person, you come back and they say, how was your weekend? Even though you may have done something wonderful with your partner, even though you might have done something amazing within LGBTQ community, maybe you did something that was fun sexually, right? But because of all of those boundaries and those restrictions that people have, or even the overt biases that people have, that person will just be like, oh, I didn't do anything. It was fine. And so they don't even get to be their authentic selves in sharing just a casual part about their lives in the same way that heterosexual people do, because heterosexual, cisgender people, their lives in general, their life trajectories at least, are celebrated in ways that trans and queer people aren't. And so think about that next time when you are in a space, like, do you get to share what you did over the weekend? And if not, how might that be reflective of your workplace culture? The last thing I'll share is just the government, and, you know, there's so much that we can unpack. One thing I didn't really target as much in this presentation is talking about how microaggressions are just one manifestation of oppression. Overt violence still exists towards LGBTQ people, and again, especially towards trans and queer people of color and of other historically marginalized groups. Overt homophobia, transphobia still exist in law and policies, and that's systemic. That's something that may take decades, if not centuries, to unpack, because these systems did not have us in mind when they started to write about the ways in which people should be able to live, or the rights that they have. And so there's systemic oppression, there's institutional oppression, the types of oppression that may occur within school systems, religious institutions, employers, etc. These institutions that may have may enforce these different forms of oppression. And then there's interpersonal discrimination or bias. And one of those is microaggressions, the more subtle types of ways, covert, everyday experiences. But that doesn't mean that the violence doesn't still exist and that the hate crimes still don't exist. And even if you're not targeted by the hate crime, by a hate crime, if you ever feel unsafe and feel that you may potentially be a target of a hate crime, that's also traumatic. So it's not just the actual being violently targeted, but living in a society where you're always on edge and where you always have to be hypervigilant. That's another example of the trauma and oppression that people may experience. And then the last piece I mentioned just briefly is this internalized oppression that oftentimes we have learned to hate ourselves, or to view parts of ourselves as being negative or inferior because of the messages that we've received in society. And so microaggressions are just one manifestation of this oppression. The systems, the individual, the institutional, and even the interpersonal and the internalized. And so when we think about the government, there are many ways in which we need to fight that system and even the institutional things that exist. But maybe we also have to think about our own selves, the internalized ways that we may view our groups as being bad or different or abnormal, and even just the smaller ways that we can address some of the interpersonal issues. I earlier talked about just this notion of that. I don't think people say that's so gay anymore as much. I know they still do, but they don't say it as much. But I think that's because we all worked. And people were vocal, and people were more braver in standing up to people when they hadn't been before, right? We know that people have been saying these things for decades, if not centuries, but there was something about the 2000s and the 2010s where people started to be braver about it. And it wasn't just queer or trans people. It was also our accomplices, our allies, our upstanders, who said something as well. And I think that's a space that we all need to continue to explore. What are some other brave things that we can do that can change our societies in some way? What are some other everyday things that I can do to combat microaggressions? And while we do need to fight the government, homophobia and transphobia, and other forms of systemic oppression, we also have to think about how can we solve some of our problems within and within our own families and communities. And so I just want to end by reading a little bit from my preface in Dismantling Everyday Discrimination. I actually haven't read this since I got this book a couple days ago. So it'll be my first time. So I apologize if I get emotional, because it's always really emotional to read your work when it finally comes to press. It's like, this is like a baby. This is my 14th baby. I had a lot of kids. But this is my book. I'm going to angle it for the camera. Okay. When I published the first edition of this text titled That's So Gay, Microaggressions in the Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Community, the world was a much different place. When I was writing the book in 2012, the United States was starting to become more accepting of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer people, LGBTQ people. Federal law had recently prohibited hate crimes based on sexual orientation and gender identity, and LGBTQ people were finally able to serve openly in the U.S. military. LGBTQ people were more visible in the media via celebrities like Laverne Cox, Ellen DeGeneres, Anderson Cooper, Elton John, and television shows, RuPaul's Drag Race, Glee, Modern Family. And before his re-election in 2012, President Barack Obama had become the first sitting president of the United States to publicly come out in support of same-sex marriage. However, there are many ways in which LGBTQ people were still being overtly discriminated against. At the start of 2013, same-sex marriage was legal in only 9 states: Massachusetts, Connecticut, Iowa, New Hampshire, Vermont, New York, Maine, Maryland, and Washington. Further, many state laws prohibited LGBTQ people from adopting children, and federal law did not view sexual orientation and gender identity as a protected class, as protected classes when it came to workplace discrimination. Overt homophobia and transphobia were still prevalent across all sectors of society, from school systems to media to families, with phrases like "that's so gay" being commonly heard in many settings and contexts. In these ways, 2013 was not so different from the decades prior. As a Filipino-American child of immigrants growing up in the 1980s, some of the earliest messages I remember about gender conformity, for example, "stop acting like a girl," "boys don't cry," "you're such a bakla," the derogatory Tagalog term for gay or transgender. As a closeted queer teen in the 1990s, I heard the word faggot at least once a day, but typically more. Sometimes groups of bullies made weird, high-pitched noises as I walked down the hall, which I discovered later was their way of mocking my femme voice. Daily, these boys asked my female friends if I was gay, why I was gay, and why I just didn't tell everyone. My female friends would tell me, and I just laughed it off. If I couldn't even admit to myself that I was gay, how was I ever to admit it to anyone else? And if I couldn't admit to being gay, how would I ever be able to tell the teachers that I was being harassed? I'd have to tell them that the boys called me a faggot, which in my head meant that I'd be admitting to being something that I wasn't ready for. By the time I was in college, I was surrounded by more liberal peers, people who did not aggressively antagonize LGBTQ people, but who were also not aware of their homophobic or transphobic language. For example, commonly saying things like "that's so gay" or "no homo" in their everyday conversations. More subtle forms of bias persisted throughout my early adulthood, with family members and strangers commonly asking me if I had a girlfriend or a wife, or heterosexual women telling me that they wanted me to be their new, quote, gay best friend. Meanwhile, homophobic slurs were also commonly yelled at me while I walked down the streets, each time triggering a fear that this would be the day that I was targeted by a hate crime. In sharing these personal stories, I hope you might understand why I wrote this book. These 9 chapters illustrate how LGBTQ people still navigate hate and ignorance, with examples of how bias manifests both overtly and subtly. These experiences have a profound effect on the lives of the people who encounter them, something to which I can attest from both empirical research and personal experience. A continual life lesson I learned is that even if the world changes for the better, with the legalization of same-sex marriage, federal protections for LGBTQ people in the workplace, and more widespread acceptance of LGBTQ people, everyday homophobia and transphobia persist. So long as trans and queer people are still targeted by violence and systemic oppression, or LGBTQ youth are still being bullied or kicked out of their homes, or LGBTQ people are still encountering microaggressions in their everyday lives, the fight for equity and justice will continue. And I sincerely hope you will join me. Thank you very much. Yes, hi.
Hi. Do you talk a lot, anything about perhaps the racism and homophobia that exists within communities like Asian American communities? And would you have any recommendations about or strategies about how people can work against that? Although I think what you're doing right here, right now, is one of those things. Yeah. You're using those things that helps in that direction.
Sure. Thank you so much. I do write about it. I write a little bit about it in this book, but I also write about it in other books as well. When I think about the Asian American community, and especially as I'm talking about this history, 20, 13, 10 years ago, and how different it is, Asian American folks have come a long way. And I think especially in places like New York, I also, I'm from California originally, so in places like California, New York, so it may or may not be reflective of everywhere, but I remember when I was growing up, to be out was like unheard of. Like I would not ever dare come out because it would be like, that would be it. Like I wouldn't be accepted in the community at all. And while I know that may still exist for a lot of folks within Asian American families and so forth, just the shift of, more overt acceptance and, I don't know why I'm getting emotional, but cause I haven't thought about this in a while. From family members, from community members, has really shifted, Like it's really, I know I said shift twice, but the shift has really, is really noticeable is what I'm saying, it used to be that saying things like, that's okay, no homo, like really like, toxic masculine types of behaviors would be not just like normalized, but even celebrated, you're so gay, like things like that. But now, and, it might be because when I walk in a room, people stop it. I don't know. but now it just feels like I overhear, people, especially young people, saying, cut it out. That's not cool. Mm-hmm. Or like, don't do that. Right. And so there's that generation, right? The young people who are really speaking out because they're learning about equity. And this is why I'm like, why would you want to take that away from young people? Why are you trying to teach them to not think about, equity in that way? But even for the elders, there's a shift, right? I think for a lot of Asian American elders, and obviously, with 40 or 50 ethnic groups, religious groups, language, immigration stories, etc., there's going to be so many nuances. But I feel like the elders, just with a little exposure and a little, common sense talking, I think a lot of them got it. Just think back to that, 2013, 2014, prior to marriage equality on a federal level. My existence, in some way, then became, in my personal life, became a way for elders to be like, oh, I know a gay person, and he's really nice to me. He's always been nice to me. And my family would be like, oh, he was always
the kid that helped us and, you know, wash dishes and helped us, like, carry boxes and all those things. So it's not like him being gay now that I know that, that this shifts anything about him. He's still him, you know? And I think that was just, like, something that I noticed that I was so afraid of. And I think still, like, rightfully so that I was afraid of it because I didn't know. There was no evidence that they would be like that. Right? But I think in my personal experience, the evidence then became shown that, like, now, like, so many people in my family, younger generations, are queer because they saw, like, oh yeah, they are really, they love Uncle Kevin, Koya Kevin, whatever they call me. Like, they love him, they love his husband, they love their kids. And so they saw the possibilities. And I think, like, for even, like, the most religious of Asian parents, and again, I'm generalizing, so I know a lot of people still have a hard time with it, but for even some of the most religious Asian, especially Asian immigrant parents of whatever religion they might be, if they were conservative in some way, if you ever, like, just expose them to, like, you know, I'm still me, I'm still a human, their humanity came out. They're like, how could they deny you if they're one to believe in, you know, especially for Christians, like, being, like, kind to people and loving people? Like, how can I all of a sudden not love you? That just doesn't make any sense. And so when I came out is when I experienced less homophobia, because now they, like, knew they had to pay attention to some of it, right? And so the last piece I'll share is actually based on, like, research, is during the marriage equality campaigns, there were Asian American activists, organizers, community organizers, both on the West Coast, East Coast, some, like, in the Midwest, where they actively infiltrated community centers, retirement homes, and churches, religious institutions, and just sat down with elderly people. And they themselves were Asian American. Some of them were probably trans or queer, some of them were not. And they just, you know, sat and heard what their concerns were. And I think that humanized the whole experience for a lot of Asian American elders. Trinity Ordonia, a phenomenal lesbian Filipina professor, activist, writer, she's written a lot about this. And this was even, like, starting in the 80s or 90s. It took Asian people to talk to other Asian people about homophobia and transphobia that made people become more open. Because prior to that, I mean, it was a white issue. Like, that's how they view it. Like, oh, this, or American, oh, this American thing. I don't know what that is. But when they saw people that looked like them, that looked like their daughter, sons, grandchildren, that they started to view that a little bit differently. So to your original question, like, what is some advice? Some advice is to live authentically, knowing you may still experience some of that homophobia within your family, but knowing that just your very presence could shift people into being more open-minded. And if that's not enough, then just having those conversations, you know, and with any conversation, it's meeting people where they're at and just saying, like, well, why do you feel that? Why do you hate gay people? Or why can't you be supportive of me? And for a lot of folks, Asian Americans and not, like, sometimes they just don't know. And not knowing why they have those biases still, they have to just resolve, like, okay, you're right, I don't have a reason, right? And so, for example, like, with, you know, anecdotally, I don't know research on this, but, like, I see a lot of Asian parents at queer weddings, you know, and that's, like, the most beautiful thing, because I think for a lot of them, it was like, what will my friends and family think? And then they have to reflect on that and be like, who cares what they think? Or why would they think anything? This is, like, a normal thing that people do. I know for me with my, I'm just rambling, but I'll say for me, like, one of the things that, like, is funny is, like, I'm like, but Tita, like, queer Filipinos, like, we're way better than everybody. We're, like, the leaders, we're the most fashionable, we're the smartest. Come on, you gotta love us. And then she reflects, and then she'll be like, oh, you're right. I do know a lot of Filipinos that are amazing, you know? And so it just kind of just shifts their, like, you know, their way of thinking, even like, you know, in psychology we call it the cognitive dissonance, it kind of just disrupts like what they think, and then they really just have no logical reason besides religion told me this. They have no other logical reason. And then with religious institutions becoming a little bit more open, like when the Catholic Church said that, you know, I know they've had their ups and downs, but when they said initially that we should accept LGBTQ people, I know a lot of Filipino Catholics were like, oh, okay, then I guess we should. Because, like, their morality is so based on, like, what is actually written. And so when they actually said that, like, they had to just shift. So thank you for that question. And yeah, I hope we can have more conversations about that. But I think, yeah, just being able to have those conversations. Oh, and then the last piece I'll say is this, I don't know, you know, anything about your identity, but for anyone who's watching, is like, if you're queer yourself, definitely do what you can, show up, your presence, et cetera, et cetera. But also, like, call on your allies, your accomplices. Like, for me, it's always, like, the running joke with me and Filipinos is, like, Filipinos never come out to their parents first. They always come out to the cool cousin first or the cool auntie. Call on that person first to support you. And then once that person supports you, they can bring in the others. They can be the ones to say, that's not cool. Don't talk like that. That's homophobic. How do you think Kevin feels about that? Like, Kevin wouldn't like hearing that. Would you like to hear that? You know, so they do a lot of that work. So you're existing, and then your allies, accomplices, upstanders are doing a lot of the work, right? They're earning that ally badge that they get to wear on their backpacks. That's a joke because allies like to wear ally bags, badges on their backpacks, but they're earning it. And then that just makes it easier for you. And then, you know, and then that, like, is a very practical way of you not being the lone voice to teach everyone else about homophobia and transphobia. Right. So I hope that helped in some way. Cool. Thank you. Yeah?
I have a question.
Sure.
As a scholar activist has been on the front lines, both within academia and also on the ground in the streets, I'm sure you've seen the rise in anti-trans legislation all around the country. Do you have any recommendations for organizers and activists that are wanting to connect the work, the harm that microaggressions connect to, like, macroaggressions?
Right, yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, there's lots of things that I think about. So, I want to overtly acknowledge that there is so much anti-trans everything in this world. I mentioned some of them before, but, like, it's severely under attack right now in ways that go beyond just the general anti-LGBTQ community, but really specifically anti-trans legislation, campaigns, etc. So my first reaction was to think about how people might want to address transphobia within our communities. So this being ARI, Asian American communities, and even like your specific Asian American ethnic communities. But one thing that I have this Instagram account at Kevin Adal. But more recently, I talked about transphobia because it really bothered me that this really popular Instagram handle, who's run by a college friend, SoCal Filipinos, was experiencing this transphobic backlash after they posted some pretty, like, innocuous, non-controversial things. They're just saying, celebrating Trans Day of Visibility, and, you know, posted some trans Filipino folks, Filipinx folks, and then there's this, all this transphobia, right? And so, like, for me, like, one thing that, you know, I said in that video is just, like, to combat people, especially people within our communities, by saying that transphobia and homophobia is a colonial concept, that prior to colonization of any of our lands, whether it's South Asia, Southeast Asia, East Asia, that came in with the Western influences, and whether it was, like, for Filipinos, Spanish colonization, for India and Pakistan, British invasion, and Southeast Asia would be a combination of, you know, French and other groups too, and then later Americans and American missionaries that went to all these places, that they brought in these ideas of rigid gender role norms. Prior to that, almost all of those groups have documented narratives of gender nonconforming people existing, queer people existing, and being celebrated. And so by virtue of somebody being transphobic in our community, I'm like, wow, congratulations, you demonstrate that colonialism has won. Because we were not initially homophobic. That's Catholicism right there in Filipino culture, right? And using that as an argument is, for me, a good stepping stone, because it helps people to at least, like, you know, reflect on why are you so transphobic, and how was this a product of something that was enforced on you violently through colonialism and Catholicism in this case. So that's part one. So having conversations with people that simply, like, again, challenge people to think about, you know, why they have these biases, and, you know, just backing them up with these receipts. Be of service. Say, what do you need me to do? Like, how can I support? To know, like, you don't have to be at the front of a protest to be effective, but you can be somebody that can provide, you know, mutual aid, can provide, you know, just practical aspects of organizing, helping people, you know, in so many different ways, but you have to take that initiative, right? Like, I know a lot of community organizers, like, there might be people who show up, but they're not willing to do that work. And so I think, you know, just humbling yourself and entering those spaces, to know that even when I enter those spaces, I'm like, how could I be of service? Because if what we're really fighting for is the cause of equity or trans rights or whatever it might be, like, we're all working in this together, and you're one person that is part of this, and we all have to do the work without necessarily wanting, you know, the recognition or the glory. In fact, like, I shouldn't even know that you were at that protest, because you're just doing the work. Like, you're not just posting about it on your TikTok or Instagram, but rather, I mean, you can. I'm not saying you shouldn't do that, but if that's the only reason why you're doing that, then that's, you know, that's questionable. And then the last thing I would say is to, like, to think about how you can dismantle transphobia in your everyday life, right? Because there are some of the actions that you can and should get involved in, but to really reflect on the ways that you have perpetuated transphobia in some ways, or even internalized transphobia in some ways. Doing that work first is important to doing a lot of things, because if you show up to spaces and you end up being transphobic yourself, or if you show up at spaces and you have a lot of unresolved traumas that you bring to the space, then, you know, that then opens the door to, like, all other sorts of dynamics that occur. And I know I'm being vague to some, and I know I'm being very specific to some who might be watching this, because of that notion that, like, I think a lot of times people show up, but they don't necessarily know how to show up, or even the impact that they have on others. And then I know I'm rambling, but just my last piece is just, like, you know, like, every day, like, I think we should all wake up thinking, like, what can I do to better this world, or what can I do to better trans lives, black lives, any historically marginalized groups. And the one thing you shouldn't do is remain silent, right? Like, I think that's something that people do, because it's so easy to just wake up and not want to do anything, and just, you know, or wake up and just do things that are self-serving, and people don't speak up, and people don't participate, or don't, you know, like, do what are even some basic things that they can do to fight for equity. And if we all do that, then that's how the status quo remains, and that's how inequity and violence continues. And so maybe we all need to reflect every single day, what is one thing that I can do today that can dismantle everyday discrimination and advocate for justice?
Online question: what's the with the recent controversy over the drag queen story?
Oh, yeah.
And the second one is that will there ever be a gay / queer study program devoted to gay studies at a higher certificate PhD program or master's?
At CUNY?
Well,
okay. So to answer your first question, like, the anti-drag story hour is a complete waste of time. It's a distraction for people to create this chaos that targets drag queens who are doing absolutely nothing wrong and, in fact, are doing so much good in these communities. And it really is a distraction from other issues, right? So, for example, whenever gun violence happens, and I'm getting political, sorry, anyone, not sorry. Let's get political. But when gun violence happens, studies show that people forget about these in within a few days. And why did we forget about these things? Because these other forms of chaos enter conversations that then distract people from what's really happening, right? Even what we saw in Tennessee is a pure demonstration of the chaos that distracts people from the realities, right? And had that not had been taken on in a national level, like, that could have been something that they got away with, right? And so with Drag Queen Story Hour, again, and even the Don't Say Gay bills, those are there to distract people from thinking about the ways in which there are other forms of oppression that are continuing, and they're also there to ignite a fear in LGBTQ people because of these increases in rights. Right. So historically, anytime any group gets some rights, there will be either overt campaigns or subtle like campaigns that try to take those rights away. There will also be, every time people get rights, there also will be an uptick in hate violence towards that community. Right. So we saw after marriage equality started to make headlines that there were these, there was an increase in hate violence towards LGBTQ people. We saw that when, on a federal level, LGBTQ rights were being protected in the workplace. Shortly after, we saw more anti-trans violence occur and so forth. And now with all of this rhetoric, essentially is what it is. And so, you know, what I encourage people to do is two things. Is one is we do have to vocally address the chaos. So by telling people, like, you know, what are drag queens doing to your children? Absolutely nothing. How are drag queens violently killing your children? They're not, but maybe these people with guns are. And to continue those conversations to combat it, because they just keep on coming back with these this rhetoric to try to make people afraid of those communities. And then the second thing that we need to do is think institutionally. And so, for example, this now leads to your second question, is if queer studies existed across all campuses, not just CUNY, but everywhere, then there wouldn't be a fear of drag queens because people from a young age, and again, like, not just on college campuses, but K-12, would learn that equity was important and would already be able to combat some of that rhetoric because they have been given the opportunity to think critically about any form of discrimination or oppression. And so this is why I think queer studies needs to be integrated on K-12 levels, age-appropriate levels across all, state and local jurisdictions. I also think this is why, you know, we need to have all studies, Asian American studies, African American studies, Latino, Latinx studies, indigenous studies, and even just ethnic studies in general, because, again, it teaches young people to think critically about themselves.
And I think CUNY needs to do that. So I'll be on record here in saying that CUNY has said that we are a pro-LGBTQ institution. But as someone who was the executive director of the first and only, at the time, LGBTQ research center out of all 26 campuses that didn't get any funding, I think CUNY needs to put their money where their mouth is and institute queer studies across all of its campuses. I know there has been some amazing work that's been happening at different places, but it's something that still is an afterthought. And when we continue to be afterthoughts and we continue to not put support, public support, financial support towards these communities that are in dire need for them, then we're essentially becoming complicit to systemic homophobia and transphobia, as well as all forms of systemic oppression. And so hi, chancellors and presidents of our colleges, we need to do something about it, and we need to do it now. So we'll end there. I won't drop the mic. This looks nice, but we'll go like that. And thank you again for being here, everyone. And I hope you all can continue to do the work and join me on this journey. Thank you so much.
I want to thank Dr. Nadal again for a wonderful presentation. You can purchase Dismantling Everyday Discrimination, Microaggressions Towards LGBTQ People online from the American Psychological Association website for $44.99. And how much are you selling your book?
$40.
Okay, $40 tonight. If you're here, please go to the APA website and purchase it from there, $44.99. The link is available on Dr. Nadal's webpage, talk webpage. And please view his other videos that he's done for us at the Institute. And with that, have a good evening. Remember to be an upstander if you see a fellow person in need, and have a good evening and weekend. Bye-bye.